There we go.
Okay, so what I want to is to go back over the material. I did cover this in a quick skimming sense earlier, and you'll see some of the same slides. But I want to go over it in a little more detail of comparative methods and phylogenies. How do you treat characters, particularly continuously measurable characters, as opposed to discrete all or none characters, when they're in multiple species? And the answer turns out to be you have to use a phylogeny. And I think I showed you all this earlier, that there's a simple null case that's one from a paper of mine 30 years ago. We have to have a level. I don't understand. I think I know why this is happening. It's okay. It's fine. And that is of having a simple-minded phylogeny with two groups, each with 11 tip species, and to use on that a model of quantitative character change, which I talked a little bit about earlier, and intend to talk a bit about more later, just because I'm kind of moving ahead to this material. And that is to say, change along a lineage is imagined to happen in these quantitative characters by a process. In this case, we're modeling it as a process of Brownian motion on a scale. And Brownian motion is a very naive, simple mathematical model which approximates what genetic drift would do as it changes the gene frequencies of the genes that are contributing additively in the simple case to a quantitative character. But there can also be natural selection. And I've mentioned, I think, the two forms of correlation among characters, one being genetic correlation, because the same genes are contributing to two traits, and the other being selective correlation or selective covariance, where natural selection is trying to change two characters in a correlated direction. So either of those could be the source of covariation between the characters. If you don't use the phylogeny, you get a wrong assessment. With the simple Brownian motion, what I did here, of course, and you saw this before, but what I did here was to simulate two characters. I'm not even giving you scale values because it's simulated data. And have them be independent. So there's an X coordinate here that's just wandering up that phylogeny, and a Y coordinate that's also wandering totally independently up that phylogeny, and you end up with this cloud of points. And most people up to the mid-1980s, and unfortunately a lot of people since who never got the word, will take that and do a regression. And they will say, oh, well, they look like book correlated, let's go test it. However, if you shade in the characters, then you find that the two groups of 11 species are in fact those two groups. There is very little evidence of covariation between the characters within each group, and all of the difference is due to those two long branches in the phylogeny in which the changes that happen to occur in them, and it happens to be the case that this group ends up here and that group ends up down there just because those two lineages happen to go in that direction by accident. Because this is an uncorrelated simulation. Well, you've seen all this before. And the way out of it that is one easy way to do that, is one easy way of getting rid of the problem is to use a phylogeny, which is presented to you by somebody who's, let's say somebody's done a lot of molecular work, and they give you a molecular phylogeny. And let's say you're willing to make some assumptions. Now, these assumptions aren't obvious. One of them is that you want to assume that there is a that these branch lengths of the phylogeny that there's a I'll call it, let's see, morphological change. Maybe I'll write it out this way. Morphological change is, I'll say proportional to, but then I'll clarify that. The branch lengths on the phylogeny. Now, if you think about that, it's not obvious. The branch lengths could be time, although then, the branch lengths on the phylogeny are the amount of molecular change that's fitted to the molecular data. And so here you have A and B. You have one that seems to have changed three times as much since their common ancestor as another. And you're going to sort, if you use those branch lengths and then try to fit change in morphological characters or any quantitative character, you're implicitly assuming that there'll be three times as much wandering on the Brownian motion scale in this lineage as there will in that. That the expected amount, and those are measured by the accumulation of variance of the change. It's the variances in a Brownian motion. It's the variances that add up. The mean, the expected change is zero in both cases because you don't know which one's going to end up further to the right on the scale. But the variance of change is proportional to those. Now, assuming that proportionality may be a controversial assumption. We do it mostly because we're stuck with it. Yeah.
Does that assume no selection?
No, it doesn't, because it assumes that the selection processes, whatever they may be, like wandering of a chasing a wandering adaptive peak, which is something I'm going to talk more about later also. We're just assuming that goes on continuously in time. And therefore, that we can approximate the result of it by a Brownian motion. Again, not 100% obvious assumption. We do it partly because we're stuck with it. We do it partly, it's kind of like critics of this model are welcome and can speak up, provided they bring with them an alternative model. So I'm presenting you a dubious model, but we're going to use it, and we're going to have to. We're stuck with it. Okay. Well, with a Brownian motion on this phylogeny, what it turns out is that you can take differences among the tips, and although these tip values are covarying with each other, I mean you can say, in fact, that the real thing to say is this. What is a phylogeny? It's a diagram of how much things covary. I mean, it's a diagram of how non-independent things are. If I am on a phylogeny next to a monkey, but we're also considering mice and elephants and lizards, the fact that I am next to the monkey tells you things about we share a lot of evolution. So it's a diagram of not... Of the amount of non, of the pattern of non-independence. Okay, so if we use that and we say, well, how can we get out of this numbers that are independent? And it turns out that the difference between A and B turns out to be independent of everything else in the phylogeny, and the difference between D and E turns out to be different, independent. Of everything else in the phylogeny, if you follow some rules, as you get these differences, which we call contrasts, off the phylogeny, and then we can scale them so that they're supposed to be not only independent from each other, have expectation zero, and have a variance which is equal once they're scaled. I'll get back to the scaling in a second. But let me say, just show you the results. The results will be four quantities. Now, if you look, let me go back. If you look here, there are five tips. in terms of taking differences, there's going to be a difference between A and B, a difference between an average of those and C, a difference between D and E, and the fourth one is going to be a difference between an average of A, B, and C and the average of D and E.
And there's a very particular way, you know, given these Brownian motion assumptions, that you have to do that.
What you end up with is a contrast. The value of the one of the characters you're looking at, let's say forearm length or something, in A and in B, and that will have an expectation zero. You don't know which one is going to be larger in advance, so the expectation is zero, and its variance will be proportional to 0.4, and I'll show you why in the formulas in a moment. Then there'll be a difference between A and B, weighted average of them, not a simple average, and C. It'll have a variance of 0.975. Difference of D to E, variance of 0.2. And finally, a difference between this, which is an average of A, B, and C, and that, which is an average of D and E.
And that has a particular variance. Okay. Just an aside, a little bit on the theoretical side, if I have two characters, let's call them character 1 and character 2, we're also going to call them X and Y,
and we have a phylogeny, and it starts out, and then here's their last common ancestor of these species, and here are the values of the characters. In the model we're making, there's a change of X and a change of Y in this branch, and there's a branch length of T1. Not necessarily a time, but a branch length. So they both change. They both change here, and they both change there.
And what it turns out, let me see if am I getting ahead, yeah, is that when you do all the covariance calculations, it turns out, I guess I'm not going to go over in tremendous detail here, that the covariance of if I say I want to know, just to get the general pattern, what will be the covariance of the X character in the first species, in the species, the upper species, and the Y character in the lower species. It's just to know what the general formula is. And it turns out when you take covariances, you can show under Brownian motion, I'm going to go back, that the changes that occur here are independent of the changes that occur here and here. So any change that occurs in here is a zero covariance with everybody else. Same thing down here, the changes in Y that occur down here, because they're in a different branch, they don't covary with anybody. They have the same starting point, but they don't covary. And it turns out that what's left after you do that is that the covariation between these two characters in respectively in different species is just the covariation you would find in the part that they share, the part of the phylogeny that they share. And so it turns out for any character K in a species I, this is in some big phylogeny, and another character J, in species L. So it's, again, two different characters that are each in a different species. So it's like my brain weight and the monkey's body weight. That the covariance under this Brownian motion will have two parts, one of which will just be the length of the branch that is there, the length of the ancestry that they have in common. All the branches that lead up, the total length of all the branches that lead up to their last common ancestor. Okay. Times something, and what that times something is the covariation of the change of those two characters in a single population. So we say that, I did say which is in which species.
So this is the covariance that you expect to find if you watch a single lineage and see the brain weight and the body weight changing. It's the covariation of change due to either genetic drift or natural selection or both. And this is simply how long they stay together before those two lineages split. In branch length terms, because we're making this naive assumption about branch length. So when you go and do that, then you can put everything together and make a big multivariate model. I'm not going to show you all the details. I'll show you a little of the algebra later, but it's just to show you it's there. If I consider a tree that is, I showed you this tree before, and I don't think I've got it here. Let me draw the tree, because I think it's important here. If we have a tree with species 1 and 2 and 3, and let's see, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Here's a tree, and they have branch lengths that are which is supposed to be related to the accumulated amount of variance, which will just number according to the tip at the top of each branch, and then we'll throw some numbers in below. We'll call this the 8, this the 9, this the 10, 11, 12. So there's the tree. I have a figure on this, and I just didn't do that. If you take one character and you ask about its variance in Brownian motion, the variance that will accumulate up a single lineage will just be the sum of these branch lengths. It'd be proportional to the sum of these branch lengths. You said? There it is. And that's here. So the variance, this is a covariance matrix of the values of this one character at the tips. And the covariance of the value in species 1 with itself is the variance of that. And it's the sum of the variances accumulated of that lineage. So V1 plus V8 plus V9. For the variance of character 2, it's V2 plus V8 plus V9. The variance of character 3, it's V3 plus V9 plus V3, and so on in this diagram. And then the interesting thing is the covariance between tip 1 and tip 2 is this value here, or symmetrically over here, and that's V8 plus V9. It's the variance that accumulated while they had a common ancestor, until they had their most recent common ancestor. So the thing I'm just trying to get from this is that you can the covariances that you see between the same character in tips has a pattern, and the pattern follows the tree, and here are the values filled out. The other thing to notice is it follows a pattern, which if you just look at the numbers, there's a number, there's a different number. This number is here. These are just different values that you would get in that same matrix. And the structure follows the tree. The structure of the matrices follows of the covariance matrix for a single character follows the tree. And then what I'm going to do, I'm going to kind of, is that this is a little technical. Considering the difference between, this is still for a single trait, the differences between tip 1 and tip 2, and also a weighted average of 1 and 2. If you consider, I want to look at the difference between 1 and 2, and then I want to look at some kind of weighted average of 1 and 2. Well, it turns out, this is to repeat the rule that I just showed you, numerical values for, that if you make the weighted average properly and you make it with weights A and P
one minus A,
where those are inversely proportional to the variances on the two lineages, so V1 and V2. So you're basically going to make a weighted average with 1 over V1 as the weight on the first species and 1 over V2 as the weight on the second species, and then you divide by the sum of the weights. And when you do that, what you get is something that is independent of one of the difference between 1 and 2. Because you can come up with a number that does not covary with the difference between them. And furthermore, this number, its covariation with everybody else, if you work through the algebra, not too difficult, is as if it were a tip on the tree that's a little bit further up than this point of their common ancestor. How much further up? It's this thing. Its total variance will be V8 plus V9 plus a little bit, and the little bit is this thing. Which, for magical reasons, it works out. So it adds a little extra branch length. So this is by way of getting to the rules that you use when you decompose a tree into contrasts. You're taking x1 minus x2, which will be tell you about what would happen on a little tree with just those two branches on it, and you're then replacing this thing by a fake tip, which is itself a weighted average of these. And you see, and with a little bit of an extra branch length, and here's a little bit of extra branch length. And there's the formula for the weighted average that I just showed you. So what you can do is you can go through pulling these contrasts off and you're basically decomposing a tree into little two-species trees, and there are n minus one of them. So if you have five tips, you'll decompose in the end into four two-species trees. And here there's a four-tip tree. It's going to decompose into three, but here's one step where you've pulled off x1. And x2. You can do this, and you can do it in, as you do this, you can do it in the character x, and at the same time, you can do it in every other character. You're doing the same operations on every character. So you're getting contrasts of x across the top of the tree, and you're getting a corresponding set of contrasts of any other character, such as y. So contrasts of brain weight, contrasts of body weight. And the formulas are all the same. And if you do that, and you make those contrasts for that 20, the two-clade example, I said a 20 species, I think it's a 22 species two-clade example, here's what you get. You get the contrast within the black clade and the contrast within the gray clade, each of them scaled. I guess I should. When you take the contrast x1 minus x2, it's now going to have come from a normal distribution. If your Brownian motion is normal, has an expectation of zero, and its variance is V1 plus V2. So the way to get a standardized back variable is just divide by the standard deviation, which will be the square root of V1 plus V2, and that should be normal with zero, mean zero, and variance one. So each of these contrasts has, as you pull it off the tree, you divide by the square root of the sum of the two branch lengths leading to those two things. And when you do that, and then they're all supposed to have the same variances, and any covariance, here's a very important point, any covariance between in the evolution of the characters now becomes a covariance of these contrasts. So if brain weight and body weight change in a covarying way, when you get these contrasts, and if it follows all this normal stuff, when you get this contrast, these contrasts, they too covary to the same they have this, basically the same correlations as they did when they're just their individual change, their changes as they go along branches. For the 22 species example, you see this. Here is the contrast between the two groups. There's just one contrast. And there are the contrasts within the black and gray groups. And you basically can see that there's no covariation. And that's a relief, because that's the way I simulated it, was with no covariation. I think I will skip over some stuff here involving talking about covariance matrices and Kronecker products and such, and I'm just going to skip it because it's the math. And basically it says that when you take the contrast, you end up with simple independent things that covary with each other. They've preserved the covariation of the characters in evolution, but they've removed all the phylogenetic covariation of the fact that a monkey's value and a human value are similar, expected to be similar. Now you've removed that by doing the contrasts.
I'm going to skip this.
And I just should say, here's a case, an interesting special case that you want to do and see if it works out. Because suppose somebody came along and said, well, I'm not going to talk about a phylogeny, but I have this extraordinary set of fossils. And what I did is, I have, let's say instead of a molecular phylogeny, I've just got time. And I know the phenotypic values of two characters, say a single character, at time zero, at time, you know, at this second point we sample, a later point we sample, a later and later. So it's a single lineage, and it has been sampled through time, not equally spaced. And they're not equally spaced, but we know what the spacing is. So we can say, well, we expect this much variance to accumulate going from 0 to 1, and then here's how much variance we expect to accumulate going from 1 to 2, and so on. Now, anybody looking at that, if somebody said, well, how do you decompose this into independent things, you'd say, well, pretty obviously, the change here is independent from the change there, is independent from the change there. So take each of those observed changes, and they have different expected variances because they're from different lengths of time. So adjust for that by dividing by the square roots of the time. And if you do that, you will get the right answer. Or you can think of it as a phylogeny. You could say, well, this observation is, imagine the line split here, but this evolved for length of time zero. It really didn't have any time to change. And then here it split, and here it split, and here it split, and here it split. But each of them never had a chance to evolve away from its the phenotypic value there. But it has the shape of a tree. If you take that shape and you follow the rules that I just gave you, you find the same thing. It'll pull contrasts off, and what are they? They're just the differences between adjacent values divided by the square root of the variances. It'll all work out. So that's, I just wanted to tell you that it all works out. Let's see. I think what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about this research program, because I think it's the one that's very relevant to using phylogenies. And then I was going to give you some more examples and talk about some of the more other complications. But I think what I'm going to do is after that, break off and let you mess with the data in your R exercise. I can always pick this up the next time I lecture. But let's talk about this for a moment. If you do this on a phylogeny using a Brownian motion model, and you look at the covariances, you use these independent contrasts, and you look at the covariances among characters, you are inferring the covariation of those characters in evolutionary change, either for genetic reasons or for selective covariances. That is, covariation of selection pressures. You don't know which. But you can imagine a research program that tried to tease that apart. And the way it would have to do so is by saying, well, this covariation in brain weight is covariant with body weight. Is it because the same genes affect both to some extent? Or is it because natural selection wants both a bigger body and a bigger brain in this environment, or a smaller body and a smaller brain in that environment? And the answer is we don't know, unless we bring something else to bear. And one of the things we could bring to bear would be quantitative genetics experiments. You might be working in an organism where you could see different species, and you could do this contrast type analysis. And some of those species are tractable for quantitative genetics, as quantitative as we spell, genetics breeding experiments. So you could take, you're working in mice, you could take breed families of mice, have measure covariation between parents and offspring, regression of parents and offspring, say, measure covariation in full and half-sid families, do a conventional quantitative genetics breeding experiment, and estimate the additive genetic covariances of the character. Estimate from additive genetic variation how much covariation is there between brain weight and body weight. You could infer the covariances, the changes along the phylogeny. That's what we get out of the contrast data. Compare that to the quantitative genetics, and then say, okay, if they're different, if the pattern of correlation is different, that is a signal that maybe natural selection, not the quantitative, not the genetic covariation, maybe natural selection is exerting correlated selection pressures. So this hasn't much been done because most people don't have phylogenetic data and quantitative genetic data at the same time. But in principle, you could do it. There's a couple minor points. If you don't have the quantitative genetic, I'll skip this fourth point, but if you don't have the quantitative genetic data, then someone might say, well, could we somehow get out which part is selective correlations or selective covariances more directly? And I would say no, except that if you had somehow a complete understanding of the ecology of the characters and the way that they would together affect the fitness, maybe there would be a way of doing it. If you said, well, this is a feeding apparatus, and these things are eating food, and we know something about the biomechanics, we could tell what happens if your lower jaw is a different length than your upper jaw. Maybe there are some ways to get at that by a complete understanding, such as a biomechanical understanding. But without that, complete detailed understanding of what the characters are doing, you'd have to fall back on comparing a quantitative genetics analysis that would get you the additive genetic stuff with a phylogenetic study that would get you the covariances of the change. And then you could say, well, if it looked to be proportional to the additive genetic covariances, maybe there's no selective covariance acting. Or you could look at it and say, selective covariance must be negative because we see a net negative change in spite of the quantitative genetics covariation being positive. So I have a feeling I'm becoming incoherent. So what I was going to show you next time, I will not really, is to go through some numerical examples and then talk about how to propagate noise, uncertainty about the tree, and then all sorts of complications. What I'm going to do is stop here and suggest that we go get back to where I was. Suggest that we try an R exercise. Did everybody? Well, choose a partner. Okay. And I put up on the site a set of data in two forms. One of which these are morphometric data. One of which was these are imaginary fish. And they've been superposed. They have 10 landmarks. It's two-dimensional fish has 10 landmarks, and there's two different methods have been used to adjust for the fact that they are of different size and adjust their location, their horizontal and vertical location, and their angles. One of them is a phylogenetic. One of them is actually the true superposition, which I happen to know because I am God and I generated this data. The second is a generalized Procrustes analysis, which is the least squares method of superposing specimens. And that's what Fred is just getting to in his lectures. So you'll be hearing about that. We're getting a little ahead of Fred. But the thing I'm predicting has nothing to do with this. And I provided you those two sets of data plus a tree. And then there is a package called APE, which is a phylogeny package written by Emmanuel Paradis in France. It is a widely used one in R. And there's a function in it called PIC, PIC, which is phylogenetic independent contrasts. And what you do is you take these things, and I give you all the steps of how to load it, how to load in the data, get the data in, and how to get it ready for APE, and how to use the tree. And there's also there is also available to you a vector. I think it's a vector of the names across the tips of the tree, which are. I believe there's 100 tips on this tree. And the tree is one that I simulated, and then I generated data going along the tree, and there is some covariation of these data. So it tells you how to apply PIC to this, how to read it in, how to do everything, how to apply PIC, and get out the contrast of a single coordinate. But then the part I've left to you is how can you do this on all 20 coordinates? One way is just to do it. I mean another way would be to write a little loop. So what I think I'll do is I'll wander around. Did everybody find the exercise and find the materials? And I'll wander around the room in circles and respond to questions, and I'll turn this